Today on Athens News Matters, a big change marks the 40th anniversary of the Athens Area Homeless Shelter.
We are actually going to be able to expand our emergency shelter space for families.
Then, the UGA program encouraging communities to address public health issues.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR's Morning Edition, which reminds you of the power of one human voice. You turn on the radio some morning, or your device, and you're listening to Morning Edition, and you hear one person telling a story from the other side of the world or from a neighborhood near you, and that voice brings you understanding of the news. Listen to Morning Edition every day.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. After turning 40 this year, the Athens Area Homeless Shelter has announced that it will close its operations on Barber Street. It will also relocate all its services to Bray Street, where it already runs a transitional housing program. Olivia Amato joined WUGA's Emma Auer for an interview to discuss this monumental change and how she hopes the transition will help her organization serve more families. Here's their conversation.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Athens Area Homeless Shelter and how it operates?
Yeah. So Athens Area Homeless Shelter began in 1986. So we're actually entering into our 40th year. And we provide a range of support for families that are in the crisis of experiencing homelessness. So that ranges from emergency shelter. So that's 45 days of supportive services on site, including childcare, everything that a parent would need in order to stabilize. And then we also provide rental assistance for families that are moving from the experience of homelessness into the community, into rentals. And then we have a transitional housing program that is longer term, and it's for parents that are getting a degree or certificate that can help them increase their income so that they can better afford housing. And then for all of our site-based programs, we have a program that brings activities and enrichment on site for family enrichment.
And how many families are typically served at any one time?
Anywhere from 20 to 25 families. We provide the support for families with kids that are under 18. And so that support, 20 to 25 families, is generally anywhere from 50 to 60 children.
Can you tell us about the scale of the issue of family homelessness in Northeast Georgia?
Yeah, so the reality is that across our region, family homelessness is a growing problem. Families are harder to capture. So we do look to the school system for their account of those experiencing homelessness. And that count is 600 to 700 right now in Clark County, and that is school-age children. And so that's just Clark County alone. And I mentioned earlier, we serve the entire region. So we have families coming to us from emergency shelter from Greene County, Clark County, Barrow County, Walton County, and we're also providing rental assistance in those communities so that if a family is returning to their community and we're able to find affordable housing, we want them to be able to do that. And so while this problem has continued to grow, oftentimes families are considered the hidden homeless. It's not going to be as apparent. It's not going to be as visible. And I want to point out, too, this isn't just a Clark County or our region concern. This is nationwide and it's statewide. So last school year in Georgia, over 40,000 children were identified as experiencing homelessness. That's school-age children. And then when we look at kids that are 3 and under, DECAL reported that close to 15,000 children that age were identified as experiencing homelessness. And so this is a problem that is, it's hard to capture, but as a community, I think that we get the opportunity to come together to respond.
The Athens Area Homeless Shelter recently made a big announcement. Would you mind telling us what that is and what the upcoming changes are?
Yeah, so I mentioned that we began in 1986. In 1990, a building was established for emergency shelter on Barber Street, and that is what most people know us for. Over the past few years, our board has been determining this aging building, how it is serving our mission, and if it is continuing to provide the support it can. And we already exist at another site as well, where we have our transitional housing off Bray Street as a part of the Arch Village complex. And so this year, we made the move to go ahead and pursue the opportunity to sell the building on Barber Street. And while we were in kind of the planning process, we were approached with an unsolicited offer, and the timing really just lined up. And so we have accepted that offer, and we have sold the building, and we're going to be moving all of our services from two locations to consolidating to one location. But in that consolidation, we are actually going to be able to expand our emergency shelter space for families.
How many families will now be able to stay in emergency housing?
On Barber Street, we have long been able to provide support for six families at a time at that location. And those six family units is about 20 to 22 beds. So this move not only is going to expand the number of families from six to eight families that we can provide emergency shelter for, it's also expanding the number of beds. And that's increasing our bed capacity by 50%. So from 20 to 22 beds of emergency shelter space, we're moving to 30 to 35 beds.
Your transitional housing program is at the Arch Village on Bray Street.
Mm-hmm.
Will the number of families being able to access that program be impacted?
No. So the reason that we have this opportunity, another nonprofit was existing in the Arch Village space with us, and they transitioned to a new location where they expanded their support, that expansion wasn't possible within the Arch Village. So that gave us the opportunity to say, we have some spaces available that we can now expand into have all of our services on one site. So this just hasn't been an opportunity before. So when you talk about things aligning the way that they need to for this to not disrupt any services for families, as well as continue to provide comprehensive support and support for larger families and more families, kind of all the stars aligned.
Well, Olivia Amato, thank you so much for your time today and for the work you do in the community.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Olivia Amato is the executive director of the Athens Area Homeless Shelter. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA.
I'm Tanya Mosley. There's so much news that it's hard to keep up, and many of those stories break in the middle of the day. Here and Now covers the news when you need it, so you're in the know.
Welcome back to Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. Water ghosts and a pair of long-lost twins meet in local author Heen Wynn's new young adult novel. Wynn's book was published by Random House late last year and explores grief, identity, and inequality through the lens of teen hijinks. She sat down with WUGA's Emma Auer to discuss her new novel and how the horror genre can explore the human experience. Here's their conversation.
Can you tell us a little bit about your book, Twin Tides? Can you give us an overview?
Yes. So Twin Tides, I call my Vietnamese-American haunted parent trap. It is about two long-lost twins, Arya and Calest, who must investigate their mom's murder and reunite in a small town haunted by a vengeful ghost. It is a YA and multi-POV, has epistolary elements, and is written in kind of a lyrical style, if that's your jam. It is both a story about a mystery, teen hijinks, but also is ultimately an exploration of kind of violence and wealth and intergenerational inheritances.
Mm. And teen hijinks, can you tell us a little bit about how that appears in the book?
Yes. So the parent trap being one of the influences, the two girls, Arya and Calest, come from very different backgrounds. So the premise is they've been separated and Arya lives in, you know, very different conditions than Calist, who is an heiress, is very wealthy. She is an influencer in LA, while Calist is a student at Georgetown and is struggling to pay her aunt's medical bills. And so she is a ghostwriter for her wealthy academic peers and is essentially a scammer to pay off some of those medical bills.
And how does Vietnamese folklore play a role in this book?
Yes. So the folktale that I wrote around is called Ma Ya, which are drowned ghosts. And in Vietnamese folktales, and it also exists in other cultures as well, drowned ghosts are essentially a warning to children, right? Be careful around the water. Don't be reckless, because these drowned ghosts may get you. And the mythology behind them is that they are drowned victims who, because of their death, because of the violence of their death, are kind of tied to earth by vengeance. They cannot move on because of their anger. And they have to claim a new life in order to replace themselves and then move on. So that is kind of the launching pad for me with Twin Tides, where I was thinking about what kind of rage, what kind of vengeance and violence would tie a soul to the earth, literally.
You open the book with a really intense sequence that you kind of just described of the water ghost, the drowned ghost. This water being is awakening and moving, and there's a sort of shifting of identity and merging of time and space. So what role does this ambiguity of who this soul is and who they're going to be, what role does that play in the book?
Yeah, thank you for picking up on that. It's really nice to know that what I write does translate on the page. So the ghost point of view is what starts off the book. It's called the ghoul in the novel. And this point of view is both human and not human. It remembers its life and doesn't remember other parts of it. And it moves in the water, right? So it's always in the state of in-betweenness and movement. And so I think part of that is the inherent nature of my book, where it's exploring grief primarily. And I think grief is definitely a state of being in between, of it being present, past, and future, and you're never really moving beyond it. And so the ghost is clearly trapped in that space as well. And then another core part of kind of ambiguity and in-betweenness in the novel is the diaspora identity of the characters. So I myself am a member of the Vietnamese diaspora, and the characters are also part of that diaspora. And so being part of diaspora is kind of in between, right? Being Vietnamese and not American and not, and kind of grappling with both our legacies and the history of our families while also trying to make sense of where we are amidst all of that.
Where can people learn more about your book?
My author website is www.authorhiing.com. That's AUTHORHIEN.com. And so you can find information about Twin Tides, but also some of my short and other published works online.
Hien Nguyen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was great being here.
Hien Nguyen is a local author whose young adult novel, Twin Tides, was published late last year. Today, on A Few Minutes With, the focus is on a community-driven effort to reshape how healthcare reaches underserved communities across rural Georgia. Dr. Henry Young, Kroger Professor of Clinical and Administrative Pharmacy at the University of Georgia's College of Pharmacy, leads an initiative known as Fishers of Men, a program grounded in trust, partnership, and meeting people where they are. Fishers of Men partners with local churches to serve as neighborhood health hubs, offering access to telehealth services, preventative care, and education for chronic conditions such as diabetes and heart disease. By placing care in familiar, trusted spaces, the initiative helps reduce long-standing barriers to health services. Dr. Young sat down with WUGA's James Hathaway to discuss the program and its impacts. Here's their conversation.
You came to the field of pharmacy and health services with a focus on underserved and rural communities. What led you to focus on rural communities and eventually to launch the Fishers of Men Project?
Well, you know, I want to start off first, my family. My family is from rural areas. My father's side is from a town called Monticello in northern Florida. And my mother's family grew up in a town right outside of Montgomery, Alabama. So, you know, I wanted to start with family first, and that really got me interested into the rural areas. So that experience, my lived experience, really centered my focus and interest in underserved and rural communities. And when I came to Georgia, the University of Georgia, I had a wonderful opportunity to engage in a new faculty tour, which exposed me to Georgia. I'm a Florida boy. So I knew nothing about Georgia. So having that wonderful opportunity to participate and engage in that new faculty tour, it really gave me an idea about what was going on in Georgia. Those experiences led to me, you know, connecting with those communities and, you know, eventually having an opportunity to engage and do some work there.
You've chosen to partner with churches and faith communities as hubs for health education and telehealth. I'm curious, why churches and what advantages have you found in that approach?
At the outset, I didn't plan on engaging with churches. You know, I had an opportunity to do some work in Pulaski County, and that was through the Archway Partnership, where I was, you know, doing a community health needs assessment for Taylor Regional Hospital. And during one of the focus groups, you know, some of the gentlemen in those focus groups were expressing concerns about not knowing what to do regarding health concerns. So after the focus group meeting, I had an opportunity to sit down and talk with those gentlemen. And I asked them if they wanted to do something about that. And they said yes. It just so happened that those individuals were leaders in their churches. When I went back down and met with those individuals, I was sharing some ideas about some of the things that we could do to address some of the needs that they talked about. And they just said, hey, we have this church group that we could probably, you know, leverage to implement these programs. So that's how it really started.
And could you walk us through a little bit how the initiative works from identifying needs in a rural county to setting up the telehealth hubs and churches and beyond?
Oh, it starts on Saturday mornings, the first Saturday mornings of the month, where we sit down at breakfast in Renee's Southern Bar and Grill in Hawkinsville, Georgia. Again, you know, I mentioned that it was a group of churches. That was a group of churches, the Interdenominational Ministerial Alliance. They meet on that Saturday morning to discuss various different issues that they see in the community. And they just invited me to come in. And, you know, on those Saturday mornings, we talk about various different issues. We talk about things from the library being closed or things such as, hey, a lot of our congregation members have diabetes. We got to do something about diabetes. So from that point, you know, we identify topics of interest. And then I say, okay, let me go back to the lab, this wonderful place called the University of Georgia. And, you know, I do some digging to try to identify some evidence-based programs. And then I bring that information back to the community. And we talk about the pros and cons of those various different programs. And then we come together as a group to decide, you know, which direction to go.
So I know that public health improvements can take a long while to show up. But have you seen any early signs of progress?
Absolutely. One of the wonderful things that I really like that I've seen is just that overarching community engagement. You know, folks want to get involved. They hear about what we're doing and they say, when's the next project? You know, we want to get involved. We want to do some things. We have these problems too. And one of the things that we just recently did, we implemented the CDC's Diabetes Prevention Program. And, you know, based on some of the analysis from our data, we're seeing some great improvements in lifestyle behaviors. You know, folks are increasing physical activity. You know, folks are, we are seeing some reduction in weight. But one of the things that I find pivotal is that folks are increasing their willingness and confidence and knowledge and skills to get them engaged in their own healthcare and be better managers of their healthcare.
So it sounds like that in a perfect world, as this program advances, you don't necessarily need to deliver the same services to the same person over and over again. As you said before, having individuals take charge of their own health, maybe they become more physically active, maybe they make some changes to their diets, or maybe it's as simple as seeking out primary care that they did not have before. Is that sort of the ultimate goal, is to lift people up and then let them sort of take flight on their own health journey?
Well, you know, I want to refer back to, you know, the name of our initiative, Fishers of Men. You know, we try to teach men to fish rather than give them fish. So this, you know, how do we empower and enable the community to address the issues that they see, to work on improving their overall health and well-being?
So as you think ahead, what's next for the Fishers of Men initiative? Are there plans to expand to more counties or to add new areas of health concern?
For us, we have a couple of things in mind. Talking with a group, you know, our group, we've identified other key problems or challenges in the communities. So we're constantly looking for, you know, solutions and things that we can implement to address those particular issues. But you hit the nail right on the head with the idea about expansion. What we want to do is we want to take this model and identify other communities across Georgia who would be interested in, you know, forming these partnerships, and then working with those communities to implement those partnerships so that they can, you know, address those community identified needs.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Young, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us.
You are so welcome.
Dr. Henry Young is the Kroger Professor of Clinical and Administrative Pharmacy at the University of Georgia's College of Pharmacy. Been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia. This week's show was produced by Emma Auer. If you missed a portion of this broadcast, Athens News Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at WUGA.org. And will be rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8. As always, thanks for listening, and stay with WUGA throughout the week for the latest in-depth local news.